if it weren't for the fact that you are todos, Rani Alechid Nudi, then I would proclaim that you should be in excommunication, Shatomachot Israel Koshimachutz, because you are causing the people of Israel to eat sacred things. In other words, it's as if you are having them eat korbanos bachutz, outside of the temple precincts.
Right.
But because you are a special exception, in other words, the community of Rome needs your spiritual guidance, so therefore I'm not going to put you into excommunication. All right, so then this should be what? This should be the fourth case, right? Except that this is not in the Mishnah. It's not in the Mishnah. So this is what the Gemara says. But Mishnah Seinu come in. Didn't we say in our Mishnah? The whole Baraisa, this is not in the Mishnah, this is a Baraisa. So, okay. So far again, he made a statement that there are 24, right? And yet, we're down to only three so far, right? And the fourth one doesn't count because it wasn't in the Mishnah. It's a Baraisa. All right. Baraisas are of the same period as the Mishnah, but technically it's not a Mishnah. Okay.
Not included.
Right. So they still are pursuing this. And tell me, there are no other mentions made in the Mishnah? Yeah, there is another one. We have learned another Mishnah says, what happens if here I have to give you the background before I can do anything else. Okay? This is based upon a very famous episode in the Gemara and Baba Metzia. Over there is related. Okay, you know that we have a rule concerning things which, if they become tome, or they become treif, all right, certain things we can make kosher. We have different methods of koshering, right? Other things, on the other hand, remain treif, and naturally, what do you do with something that's treif? You throw it out, or you break it to pieces, or something like that. Okay. So here is a stove, case of a stove, which was made of porcelain. Okay? In other words, it was kli cheres. It was made, out of pottery, the same pottery material, and so on, burnt with a glaze, and so on. So maybe it was like porcelain, or something like that. But it became tome. Something in there, that was burning happened to be tome, and therefore it made the whole thing tome. So what to do with this particular stove? This, of course, is not an iron stove we're talking about, you understand? We're talking about a stove which was made of clay, which was hardened and used in order to burn things in. But the din concerning this type of a stove is that of clay cheres in general, which, as I said, for example, it was a treifa dish, you don't kosher it, that's all. Throw it away, okay? Or you use it for some treifa purpose or base. My wife uses it for a flower pot or something like that. It's a base, to put flowers on or something like that. So, Rabbi Elazar had a different idea, but I see it's already time to daven mincha, so we'll save this to be continued next week as a cliffhanger.
Okay.
So next week in Mitzvah Hashem we will meet again at 7 o'clock and continue the pursuit of Torah. Okay?
So what was
it It says, don't we say in the Gemara Menachos, where they have a parak called Hatcheles, Ahi Shata Vadev Aminin Le. It says over there that at that moment, which would mean when a person is dying, so Raminenle, we do put in tzitzis, perish nostin tzitzis betali sehem, that we put in tzitzis in the talis. Why? Mishum loeg lerosh, because it's a question of mocking the dead. So there's a contradiction between what the Gemara says in Menachos about inserting tzitzis so that the dead will have tzitzis to accompany him, you understand? As compared to what we said just a moment ago, that you don't drag tzitzis on the Beis Elam in order not to insult the dead, okay? So the question is, how can we resolve this contradiction? V'yesh loymar. So therefore, one explanation that Tosfos entertains is the Hochi Pirusha. This is how we are to explain it. In the case where we said you come to the Beis Elam, right, and you drag your tzitzis, we are causing them to feel ashamed. How? In that, those who are alive are commanded to perform mitzvahs, and those who are dead are not commanded to perform mitzvahs. And we have a famous statement in the Gemara which says, "V'godol hamitzuma ve'oisa," someone who is lo mitzuma ve'oisa. In other words, greater is a person who is commanded to fulfill a mitzvah and he does it than one who is not commanded to fulfill a mitzvah and he doesn't. It's a Gemara in Aveda Zora, it's a Gemara in several other places that we find it. Okay? In other words, we are saying to the dead, says Tosfos, that if we drag the tzitzis over there, we are flaunting in their face the fact that we have the obligation to fulfill mitzvahs and we're fulfilling them, whereas they don't have it, and therefore we put ourselves in a superior position, so to speak, vis-a-vis them. Okay? So this is one explanation. Whereas he says, V'ahit et cheles, but that the reference that we had in the Perakat Chelis in Menachos, it says, "Hainu yiromu chutim lemesim." There we're talking to the fact that they did have a custom that when they buried them with a talus which had tzitzis. Okay? However, now we come to the custom, says Tosfos, of what we observe. The Yachshov onu misalkin atzam. And now what do? We remove the tzitzis. You know that, you've had to do with the talus, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of a talus do you put on?
I've never seen it used.
Oh, you've never seen it, right? Well,
it just depends on the tzitzis.
Okay. One custom in reference to the talus that they put around the mess is that they remove one of the tzitzis. Mm-hmm. One of the tzitzis they remove, right? In order to make it a puzzle talus, right? The idea being that since they are not commanded, you see, to wear the talus, so that therefore this is the reason why we remove one in order to show it. So I say it's in reference to this that we're talking about over here. Okay?
You just have to remove one.
Right. Umayshno, so tell me what is the reason, actually is what it should be. It should be my Tama, as the note on the side says. So Imur Rabbeinu Tama, Rabbeinu San Tavke, he says, in the olden days we had such great tzaddikim who were accustomed to wearing a talus with the four, with the upper compass, and to wear them day and night and so on. The gam lechol oiskim bohem yesh lehem tzitzis, and likewise whoever had anything to do with them also wore tzitzis day and night. So, v'hava lo'eg l'rosh im lo hayo lehem tzitzis. So, it would have been a lo'eg l'rosh, in other words, a mockery of the dead, if we did not give the dead a talis with tzitzis. That's why the Gemara in Menachos says that we do put in tzitzis over there. Okay?
You just put it into the casket, or you put it around the mess?
You put it around the mess before you wrap them around. Right, yeah. Usually they do it after they're in the top
grip.
Right,
yeah.
But you put it in the casket, right, wrap them around. Okay? All mishum dechsev the doraisa. Or another interpretation. It's written, concerning tzitzis, the dorosam. Now, what does it mean that there are some in every generation? But he gives a drash. The drash is the dor tam. In other words, a generation which is perfect, where they are accustomed that no matter what their activity is, they're always wrapped in a talus, they're always wearing tzitzis. Abol onu, but we, shegam v'chayenu en min hogenu libosh tamit tzitzis, our custom is not to wear tzitzis all the time. Certainly we don't wear a talus all the time. And even in Talis Kotten, we've already learned that this is a Ksus Yom, right? It's a Beged Yom. it's a garment for the day, but you're not obligated to wear it at night. I mean, you wouldn't wear a talis cotton, for example, under your nightshirt or on top of your pajamas when you go to sleep or something like that. You understand? So since our custom is not to do that, so ihavar aminin lehu, then if we would put in tzitzis into their talis, havakamiloi b'rosh, and it's as if we were making fun of them. So this is how Rabbeinu Tam explains it. And then he says the same thing, right? As far as women is concerned, how can you do it in the case of women? You're going to put in tzitzis and put a talis around a dead woman? You don't do that. Okay, so our custom is not to do it, and therefore if we would go dragging tzitzis in the Beis Elam, or if we wrap them with a talis with all the tzitzis of being kosher, then in that case, he says, it would be loing l'rosh, we'd be mocking the dead. The Yodam Rabbeinu Tam, and in addition, Rabbeinu Tam said, Sheshoma miyanshe Loter, he heard from people in Lorraine. Loter is the old name of Lorraine. It's, one of the provinces of France, okay? And many Jews lived over there. So, the Mesirim HaTzitzis, that what they do is to remove the tzitzis from the talis. Why? The tzitzis oile leminyan taryag. We know that the word tzitzis itself comes up eventually to the number taryag im cheschut im chamisha kesharim. That if you add the 8 threads and the 5 knots, and that you add to the word tzitzis, so you're going to find a total of taryag. Tof reishu gimel, which of course is the number of the 613 mitzvahs, right? So, the im loibesh tzitzis, and if he were to wear tzitzis, so nira kilu kiyem kol haTorah, it's as if he would fulfill the entire Torah. Umechse kishikra, and then it would seem like, he was telling a lie. Gazelo nihira, but Rabbeinu Tam says, I don't see it. The gam chayim ato loma lovshim alo lo kiyimu kol haTorah kilo, because he says, if tzitzis mean that we have fulfilled the entire Torah, even people who are alive today, he says, and they wear tzitzis, but does it mean to say that they have fulfilled every single mitzvah in the Torah? Well, nihu, nevertheless, he says, yesh loma, we can explain the onu som chima maseches machas. What we are doing in our practice is to rely upon Maseches Machos. Maseches Machos deals with the laws of Avelis. Okay? Deals with Avelis. So it says over there, Shetziva Abashol Livonov, that Abashol commanded his sons, Atilu Techeles Meapil Yone, he says, take off the Techeles from my tzitzis, the Yafal Pi Shagamora Cholekalov, and even though the Gemara disagrees with him, Yesh devorim she'onim anichim hagmore she'lonim yonosim kisforim achitzonim. There are times, he says, when we do not follow what the Gemara has to say, but instead we rely upon books which are outside of the Gemara. As for example, this Maseches Machos, which is a somewhat later compilation of laws pertaining to Avelis. And he gives other examples as well. For example, Kemol mechazon yishayol kipsikdo. This I'll skip over, but we know that chazon yishayahu, this is what we read on the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av. But we'll go to the next example of the quotes. Kemol vayichal. What do we do on a fast day? On a fast day, on a tainis, what do we read? We read vayichal Moshe, right? We read it both in the morning and the evening. Okay. Whereas Sheyesh B'Gemara, the Gemara and Gemara Megillah says that the Bitan is on a fast day Korin Brachos Uklolos, where they say that on a fast day you should read what we call the Teichicha today. Okay? Yet nevertheless, what is our practice? Our practice is to do Vayechal, right? Maseches Sofrim, and in Maseches Sofrim, which is also one of the later works, so Meforesh, he explains, what do we read? Vayechal. And of course, what do we follow? We follow what the later one says rather than what the Gemara itself says. And finally says Tosfos, the Horitzba, one of the great authorities of his time, He says he had the custom not to remove the tzitzis from the corner, but rather to tie them up and stick them inside, so that it shouldn't be, you know, should not, the fringe should not be seen hanging down. Instead, it was tied inside over there. And why? It's because he didn't want to get involved. Should you put in tzitzis the way Gemara says in Menachos, or should you not? Should you remove the tzitzis as we have over here, right? So he didn't want to get involved, so therefore he tied it up and put it in, right? So the Yimlav Harehim, so he says, Im hem chayom mitzitzis, if we really are required to have tzitzis, you know, in the best, then yesh lahem tzitzis. So they have tzitzis for Yimlav, and if not, so Harehim chusim. Behold, they are covered up. So as we see, to this very day, we follow the custom that Rabbeinu Tam said. So do you need a receipt or not?
No.
No. Okay. Second opinion, which is mentioned over here, namely to tie them up and cover them up so that you don't see the tzitzis hanging.
Where would you put them into?
You stick them in underneath over there, you know, just tie it and tie it and tie it so that it no longer hangs as a fringe. Okay? All right. Next week in B'yitzah Hashem, we will learn. I think next week, if I'm not mistaken, the time of davening goes up to 8 o'clock, I think. So in that case,
I have it. Yeah.
Keep it ready, right?
Get it ready.
I always keep comfortable.
Okay, we are now on Yud Ches Omid Beis. Okay, the last thing that we did in the Gemara itself was to go over this little medrash that they have, if you wish, or Nagada, about Benayahu ben Yehoyada, right? And it says that he was Ben Ishchai Rafi Olim, and of course, as we saw, this would imply, you know, that he was the son of a man who was living, of course, and the Gemara automatically asked the question, how are we all children, you know, of living fathers? But the answer is no. What the implication is that Tzadikim Mechayehem Nikru Chayim, that even when they are dead, the righteous are still alive. Of course, it means very obviously, I mean, the fact that their teachings, their inspirations, and so on, these things continue to go on even after their death. Facebook, if you remember, pointed out the fact that they got it from the Kesiv, in other words, from the written text where they use the word Chai, but that the Kri is Chayil, Benish Chayil would simply mean, you know, that he was the son of a valorous person. And then after that, they continue by saying that on the top of page Yud Ches on the days. And so it says, Rav Pionin Katziel, what is the meaning of that part? And namely, that he was a man who was full of activities and he came from Katziel. So they say, Sharibo Vekibetz Poalim Latorah. Meaning is, they say that he multiplied and gathered all kinds of people to work in the study of Torah. The Hu Hiko Shnei Ariel, literally he smote the two Ariels, Ariel Moav, and this was a little bit more figurative in the interpretation, that first of all the Ariel, they identify with the Beis HaMikdash, and the question of course automatically is, what does Moav have to do with it? So the answer is
Dovid HaMelech,
right, who had in his mind to build the Beis HaMikdash. So that therefore, according to Tosfos, you know, the Shnei B'nei Ariel refers actually to Dovid and Shlomo, you see, that the two of them were involved in building the Beis HaMikdash. Dovid conceived the idea and wanted to go ahead with it, and Shlomo eventually was able to carry it out to fulfillment. But the Gemara over here refers to it instead, yes, of course, what is the connection with Moab? So as we said, because Dovid HaMelech was a descendant of Ruth HaMoabiyah, you know, Ruth the Moabite woman. And but they take it, you know, the Shnei Ariel, in the sense of the two Botei Beis HaMikdashes, all right, or Botei Mikdash, to be a little bit more precise, namely the first one and the second one, and it says, Shalom Yiniyah Kamoisai, Loi B'Mikdash Rishon, Loi B'Nasheni. There was no one like him, either in the first the days of the first temple and the days of the second temple. And then what is the meaning that he went down and he smote the lion in the midst of the pit on the snowy day? I mean, we can take it, of course, literally, you know, that he performed an act of heroism by killing a lion
on a snowy day.
On a snowy day. Well, don't forget, there it just feels sometimes you have snowy days. It happened maybe 2-3 times a year, okay? And so here was the lion that was in his den, in his pit, and he went and he killed it. So he was a hero. But, Iko de Amre, there are those who refer this is already new for us, that the business of going and Iko es Ariv es Ochabor, this shows his heroism in a different way. Iko de Amre, there were those who say, what did he do? The Sovar Gezize de Bardo, Benochas Betova. They say that he broke pieces of, well, Barod, of course, means, you know, like hail or ice. And he went down and then he was Toivel in it. It's like, for example, they used to tell stories of, you know, women in Europe, for example, that they were really so devout that, for example, if there wasn't a mikveh handy in the town itself, that let's say the husband would go and chop the ice in part of the river and part of the pond, whatever it may be, so that the women then could go and to be tefillin. I don't have to tell you how cold the water must have been over there, but they did it l'shem mitzvah. And I've heard tales, you know, of that. So this would be analogous to it, that he chopped the ice in order to be able to go and be tefillin. Iko de Amre, there were those who say that what was his heroism, that he was like a lion. It says the Tana Sifra de Beirah B'yomit Sisva. They say that there's another mandoma, in other words, there are those who say that the verse means that he learned the entire Sifra de Beirah in one winter day. Now, first of all, I don't have to tell you that it's not the easiest feat in the world to go right through the entire Sifra. Sifra, by the way, I have a voice left tonight, is the Medrash, the rabbinic commentary that goes back to the time of the Tanoim. In other words, it's contemporary with the Mishnah, okay? And it is the commentary on Sefer Vayikra. Okay? Now, since, you know, we're almost at the tail end of Sefer Vayikra right now, we're finishing it, Blinera, you know, this Shabbos morning, read the last two parshios. So, you know that the first half of Sefer Vayikra is a very technical thing. Good evening, David. How are you? It's very technical. They deal with all kinds of karbonas, first of all, okay? And then after they get through with the karbonas, I mean, that occupies quite a few chapters. So then they go into other areas that are devoted to the concept of kedusha, being holy. But the first chapters deal with such things as being holy, for example, by virtue of keeping kosher, being holy by virtue of observing taras and mishpacha, by being holy in the matter of what do you do in the case of a person who is, you know, is diagnosed as having leprosy, or even a house that is suspected of harboring leprosy, or a garment that may be leprous, right? And then after that, they go into a description of Yom Kippur. How are you supposed to observe it? And then you go into the whole problem of arroyos. What is permitted in relations and what is prohibited by relations and so on. And then after that, they first get into what we've been reading the past few weeks, namely basic concepts of holiness in our relations with our fellow man, but also holiness is expressed, for example, that, you know, it's... take a look at the beginning of Kedoshim. And starts off by telling you, no, Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kodesh Ani Hashem, right? You should be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then what is the first thing that it deals with? Well, it deals with actually what our sages call like a little concise version of the Ten Commandments, like Ish Obev Yimo Tiro, in other words, revere or fear your mother and your father, Yesh Apsosai Tishmo, keep my Sabbaths, right? And then after that, what do we have? We have, for example, Kutzrachem is Kitziratzachem, when you are reaping your harvest, make sure that you leave a corn in the field for the poor. Another sentence tells you the same area right over there, that if you're sacrificing shlomim, so you have a time limit as to how long you can eat it. In the case of shlomim, for example, happens to be 2 days with one night in between, okay? In the case of todah, then it's only that day and the night that follows, okay? And that's it. And what happens after that? So, of course, it becomes nosor, it becomes pigul. In other words, it becomes an abomination, has to be burnt in fire and destroyed. You're not allowed to have any use of it. But the point that I'm making is that the sifra then has to deal with this miscellany of laws that we find in Sefer Vayikra, from details concerning how do we understand the text of the Torah when it comes to the various sacrifices, how are you supposed to do it, what can you use, and so on, what is the role of the Kohen and things like that, what does he have to do, as well as dealing with the leprosy and so on, you know, how can you recognize what are the Maros, the Goyim, in other words, the what do the forms of leprosy take, so that, for example, a Kohen should be able to distinguish between whether the person is clean or is he infected, is he tummy as a result, and things like that. And then dealing with all the other miscellaneous things that I've mentioned. So they're saying that he was like a lion, according to this Ikud Amre, you know, those who say, they say he was heroic, he was like a lion in that he was able to learn the entire Sifrot de Beirah in one winter day. Now, of course, you realize the day varies in length, right?
Winter.
Right. In winter, we know it's at its shortest. So that this truly was a heroic feat that he was able to do it. I know, I try to keep up with the Daf Yomi. And believe me, it's a heroic struggle in order to try to do it, but unfortunately, you have telephone calls and you have your wife bothering you and
you fall behind.
And you have other work to take care of and things, you know, and you want to keep up with the world and find out what's doing and read a paper. It's a job, it's a heroic job in order to try to keep up. And that's one blot a day, which is not easy. And imagine going through the entire Sifra, you know, in one single day.
How much does Sifra differ from some of the other commentaries that are on Sefer Vayikra?
Okay. The Sifra is essentially what we would call a halachic midrash, okay? In other words, the concentration is primarily upon how do we derive a halacha? What is the practice that we can learn from the understanding and the interpretation of the text? That's its nature. Okay? Whereas, when we come to, for example, the Medrash Rabbah, the Medrash Rabbah is primarily agadic in nature. All right. Now, do you understand the distinction between halachic and agadic? Let me explain our regalachas on one foot right now. What is the difference between them? Halacha, we know, means
law.
How do you practice? What is the din? How can we observe the din? This is what halacha deals with, okay? So, the halachic midrashim, such as the Sifra, which is upon Sefer Vayikra, such as the Mechilta, which covers part of Sefer Shmos, and the Sifrei, it's easy to confuse Sifron and Sifrei, but the Sifrei, which covers Bamidbor and Devarim. And the emphasis, as I said, is primarily upon the halachic sections that we find. what are the dinim that we can learn, and so on and so forth. And of course, they bring in, you know, various differences in the point of view. A great many of the interpretations have also been incorporated within the text of the Gemara itself, you know, in various places in the Talmud, okay? And then you have, on the other hand, what we call the Agadic Midrash. Agada means that these are stories that we tell about the great heroes in the Torah and Tanakh and so on and so forth, in order to learn more about them, to try to understand them better, in order to understand their character and so on and so forth. So that anything which is not halachic in nature can sort of be considered as being agadic. Okay? It's like the famous play by Molière. I don't know, the Bourgeois Gentilhomme, I don't know if any of you ever read it. But in this particular comedy, Molière, he deals with a certain guy who has gotten rich and he wants to act like a nobleman, so he needs instruction. So he hires a whole group of tutors in order to teach him. And one of the tutors is going to teach him the whys and the wherefores of the French language. And so, you know, he starts him to tell him that there is such a thing as poetry. And then he tells him a great rule. He says, whatever is not poetry is prose. So he wants to know, if I say, for example, to the maid, go and bring me, let's say, a cup of coffee or something like that, or go and do the underwear or something, or wash the underwear, whatever it may be, what am I doing? Am I speaking poetry or prose? So he tells him, that's prose. He says, oh, he's discovered that what is not poetry is prose, and what is prose is not poetry. Or what is not prose is poetry. So the same thing, I mean, we can sort of say that what is not halacha is agada, okay? Now, the Gemara, of course, is a mixture of halacha and agada. Right now, what we are dealing with when they deal with Binayahu ben Yehuda, Yada, you know, and they interpret the verses in order to demonstrate his heroism, and in fact, the whole section that we're going to have right now, this is agada, okay? In other words, it's not halacha in nature, but it's agada. But on the other hand, when we learn about the ovel and what are the dinim that apply, what is he, you know, when is he potter, for example, from kriya shema and from putting on tefillin and from shmona esrei and things like that, and when is he allowed, you know, to bench and or to have people make a motzi for him, and so on and so forth. This is Allah. Okay? This is law. David asked me if I would review for a few moments again what are the three stages in mourning, in Avelis. Okay? All right. So, stage number one, death occurs. Okay? But we have to take care of the arrangements for the burial of the dead. Okay? Now, the immediate relative, therefore, is now considered an onen. This is his official title. Or we refer to it as the period of being aninus. Okay? Aninus. This is the point, you know, where he is excused from performing all the mitzvahs, provided, of course, what? That he's busy concentrating on the problem of making sure that the dead person is going to receive an honorable burial.
All the positive commandments.
Right. So he's excused from observing all the positive commandments, which include, as we said, Krishna, saying Shmona Esrei, putting on tefillin, okay? And not only that, but we also added a few other things. He cannot eat meat, he cannot drink wine, okay? Obviously he cannot have any marital relations, okay? And we also learn he doesn't even say hamotzi before a meal. He doesn't bench after the meal. He cannot be counted to a mezumen. No one can make hamotzi for him, you know, because as I said, for example, if you have a group, one person can say hamotzi for everyone. Like, for example, Shabbos afternoon. when we gather over here for Shalosh Shunas, okay? We don't have to make an individual hamotzi. It's considered more choshev. I don't say that the other is prohibited, but I'm saying it's a little more choshev. It's considered a, let's say, a mitzvah of a higher caliber if one person recites the hamotzi for everybody, and the others, of course, have to remain silent.
Say amen.
They say amen, but they still can't talk after that until they have also gotten the piece of the challah, you know, that they eat. So that this is for a festive meal, okay? So the onen cannot be yotze, in other words, with that person doing it for him, because he's not required to do it, and so he cannot even rely upon the other. And the same thing, that he cannot be added to the mizuman for benching after the meal. This is as long as he is an onen, as long as the burial has not taken place. Okay? We also, however, added one other thing. We added another baraisa, which says that on the Shabbos, however, since the burial cannot take place, then he does all the things that we said he doesn't do. In other words, he can eat meat, and he can drink wine, and he can bench, and he can be counted to a mezumen, and he davens, and so on.
Resumes
and so
normal,
right.
Normal life.
Resumes normal life as long as it's Shabbos. Obviously, when Shabbos is over, then he has to go back again to being an onen. Okay? And if you remember, there was one point of difference between one baraisa and another one of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, where he asked that he's required to perform all the mitzvahs of the Torah, and the Gemara wants to know what is not covered, you know, weren't all the other things, all the mitzvahs of the Torah? And they say, well, the one thing that wasn't discussed was marital relations. That according to the Tanakam, in other words, the anonymous author of the Baraisa that we quoted first, that's the one area in which he does not take part, okay? Whereas, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, whose opinion is not followed in this particular case, it would be, you know, considered a mitzvah to have marital relations Friday night, and therefore he should do that as if, you know, everything was normal in that case. All right. At any rate, this is Aninus. Okay. Now, finally, the burial takes place. By the way, the Onen does not recite Kaddish yet, because when do we first recite Kaddish?
At the graveside.
Right. When burial takes place, then we first recite a Kaddish. Okay? All right. Now, the burial has taken place. At this point, once the casket is covered, at this point, the laws of Avelis now take effect. So he's now in the second stage, which is an Olel, observing Shiva. Okay? This is the next stage. Now, the Olel, observing Shiva, again, has various rules and regulations that he must follow. Well, he davens and everything else, but one proviso of the first day, what usually happens to coincide, you know, with the day of the burial, okay? The proviso is that he's not allowed to put on tefillin on that day. But, except for that, he would be davening, I mean, make a minyan in the house, he certainly davens, right? What is he not allowed to do? All right, so he's not allowed to do the following. He is not allowed, for example, to wear leather shoes. Okay? Normally you go around in slippers or in stocking feet. I suppose you get by in, you know, canvas sneakers. But, you know, with sneakers, you got to be careful, because some sneakers have leather parts to them. And if they have leather parts, then they cannot be used. You're not used. It's the same deal, you know, as far as Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av is concerned. It's the same thing. Okay? All right. The first meal when they return from the Beis Elam should be a meal brought in by others, because the food has to be prepared by others for him. That's called the Seudas Havrah. From that point on, he is permitted to prepare his own meals, but that very first meal has to be prepared by others. Havrah, Hey Beis Reish Aleph Hey. Okay, literally it means healing, the healing meal. Okay, and there's even a special bench in the middle, you know, when it comes to the third bracha, before Bein Rachum and Yerushalayim, there's a special one, just like on Tisha B'Av, we have a special prayer in which we pray to God, you know, to console all of us who are in mourning for Zion. So here the same thing, you know, we say, may God send consolation to the mourning, to the mourners who are in the midst of this great sorrow and so on. But you rarely find it today. Most of the Siddurim have left it out. However, I think that Art School finally decided to repent it. So if you're looking for the text, you can find it. I have an old Siddur at home, an old English Siddur, where it is. Of course, in you know, the Shulchan Aruch and so on, you can find the Nusach over there too. But why Siddurim no longer have it, I don't know. I guess that simply fell into disuse as far as the average person is concerned. Okay, but there is a special
benching.
A special benching, right, to be recited, okay? Now, in addition, because the Ovel is not permitted to have any marital relations, and this includes Friday night as well, okay? The Ovel is not permitted to go to work, we know that. The Ovel is not permitted to wash, except to simply wash, let's say, his hands and the eyes and so on, with cold water. Of course, we learned about Rabban Gamliel that he said that he was what? He was an Istinus, if you remember, right? And therefore, he said, you know, this is the reason why I have to bathe with warm water and so on. But it doesn't mean that everybody can say, okay, I'm an Istinus from now on, I'll do, you know, what Rabban Gamliel said. You try to observe as much as you can. Of course, other things, you'd have to let your hair grow, beard grow, and things like that. You don't do that, okay? On Shabbos, as I mentioned before, the Ovel during Shiva is not allowed to observe what they call Avelis Bevar Hesyo, in other words, public demonstrations of Avelis. For this reason, he's permitted to come to Shul in order to daven. And he's even permitted to wear shoes because he's going out in public and so on, right? He's permitted to sit on a regular chair on Shabbos. He doesn't have to sit on a low stool or anything like that, or on the ground, which was the original thing, right? But as I said, the one restriction on Shabbos, you know, is not to have marital intercourse. The Ovel is permitted to eat wine, it's permitted to eat meat, he's permitted to drink wine and so on. You see, that prohibition was only during Aninus, but during the Ovelus it is already permitted to have that. So these are some of the things, and of course there's one other prohibition, that is not to study Torah during this time. This is the reason why the Ovel is not given an Aliyah during this time. Okay?
You can read Tillon and things.
Yeah,
like,
well,
that.
I said last week that there are certain parts of the Bible that could be studied, as for example the book of Job, since it deals with, you know, tragedy, or let's say some tragic parts in the book of Jeremiah or something like that. That is permissible to be studied. Particularly the book of Job is considered being permissible. Right. But, you know, to sit down to study, let's say, the weekly Seder or something like that, no. But, on the other hand, there are those who do, let's say, learn in the house of the Ovel, so that the Ovel can listen and then recite the Kaddish Rabbonin, you see, after. That is permissible. But for the Ovel to sit down and to study a Blat Gemara or something like that is considered out of bounds during the week of Shiva. As I say, you don't give them an Aliyah either at that time. Alright. Now, when Shiva comes to an end, we still have another period which began also at the time of the burial, and that of course is Shloshim, 30 days, where the mourning is not so intense in that, you know, you're permitted to bathe, you're permitted to go to work, these things you can do, okay? But of course you still have to observe mourning even at this particular point, as for example, not to go to any place of entertainment, concerts, dances, things like that, and so on, movies, you know, you don't go during the time. There are many who observe a law in the Shulchan Aruch that says that the tear that you make in the garment, while it can't be sewn, it can only be sewn partly, and you know, you wear it during the 30 days. Some wear it only during Shiva, others wear it during the entire Shloshim period. Okay? Alright. Now, those are the three stages, but there is one further stage.
Is it halachic that a novel is not allowed to daven, let's say, for the Yomid on Shabbos or on Yom Tov?
There is such a practice mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, right.
Is it a law
there
or is it a custom?
Well, I don't know whether you would call it a din or whether you'd call it a minhag. I would prefer to say minhag. Okay? But the minhag is that the Ovil does not daven for the Yomid, either on Shabbos or on the important days upon which we omit Tachlin, like for example Rish Chodesh, Chol HaMoed, and things like that. Right. So those days would be considered not proper. But for example, let's say to daven on an afternoon, Erev Lag BaOmer or something like that, where we omit Tachlin, but that's all right. I mean, you could daven at that point in any case, okay? But definitely there is such a practice, no question about that. So if you're in the shul where this is the practice, and this was the traditional practice here in Kadima, okay, that the Yovel did not go to daven either on Shabbos or on Rosh Chodesh or Chol HaMoed or something like that. Okay. Avelus, as I pointed out, ends for everybody at the end of Shloshim, except that if you're in mourning for your father or your mother, then you observe 12 months, of course, again, starting from the time when the burial took place, okay? You observe 12 months, or up to the Yahrzeit anyway, up to the Yahrzeit. You observe not to go to public simchis, or whatever it may be, so that you wouldn't be going again, as I say, to the movies, the dances, and things like that, the theater, and so on. You wouldn't do it. And even weddings, correct. I mean, with weddings, there are some who say that if you go as a waiter, you could. But in general, if you don't have to go, you're better off not to go to it. And people will understand. Look, when I was mourning for my father, there were certain events over here at Kadima which I simply did not go to, and that's all there was to it. I mean, it was Omentan. So somebody took umbrage at it, was all of time. My father's memory was such that I felt that I had to honor him more than to take part in, some great big festivity.
Well, Phil, I got Israel.
Yes.
My brother-in-law passed on. It was a puzzle.
Yeah.
He was buried an hour and a half after he died.
That doesn't surprise me, because in Eretz Israel, they're not waiting for somebody to come in from Miami or from California or something like that.
His son with him the whole day.
Yeah. I mean, what happens is, that the Chevra Kaddish immediately performs the Torah, and as soon as possible they bury. This is considered the big mitzvah, because you're not supposed to delay burial. It's written, Le'solin nivlosei al ha'weid. So from this we learn the positive commandment that we should not delay burial in any way. Okay, so that if you can possibly do it as fast as you can, it's considered a mitzvah.
That's right.
Pardon me?
He's only an onin for an hour and a half.
So he's only an onin for an hour and a half. That's absolutely right. And then he became an ovel after the burial. Right. Mm-hmm. Correct. But as I say, the basic idea there, you see, that it's considered a kovod hames, in other words, honor shown to the dead, to try to give them burial as soon as you possibly can.
Said something. You said that he's an ovel for, if it's his father or mother, God forbid, he's an ovel for 12 months.
Correct.
Yet he only says Kaddish for 11 months.
Okay. That leads us to another area. All right. This is about saying Kaddish. Okay. Technically, which means that the dead person is not forgotten, since that mourning doesn't stop for the dead until after 12 months have passed. We're also told that we're not allowed to mourn overly much. We mourn the prescribed periods, but don't overdo it. you know, do more and more and more than we have to. In other words, we can't go around for the rest of our life feeling gloom and mourning and so on and so forth. We have to live a normal life, okay? So, why do we say Kaddish only 11 months? This is the question, okay? The answer is that we say that even the Rishoyim, their punishment is only 12 months. Of course, I'm not talking like a Hitler. I'm talking about, you know, the average Joe who has more sins than he has merits, okay? So, the longest amount of time that he's going to have to spend in Gehinnom, you see, before he can go and have in Elias the Shami, you know, to go higher and higher, would be 12 months. Since we don't want to say that the dead person for whom we are reciting the Kaddish is a Rasha, so therefore we stop before the beginning of the 12th month. So that, you know, let's say that somebody passed away, let's say on the 10th of Iyar, all right? So you would say it through the 9th of Nisan, okay? In other words, that would be the last day. You don't say it anymore on the 10th of Nisan because that's already the beginning of the 12th month, and we don't want to say. So this is what the practice is. But, you know, let's say you're saying Kaddish for a brother or a sister or something like that. All that you're required to observe as far as your own Avelis is concerned is just Shloshim, the 30 days. But to say Kaddish, that's an additional mitzvah, you see. It's an additional merit because you are giving an ilui, you know, you're helping to raise the neshama, you know, to a higher plane. So that, we do it for 11 months.
But this is a really stupid question. But
yes.
Okay, Kaddish, is it mandatory to say it once a day, three times a day? I mean, what is...
Well, I wouldn't say that there is an absolute fixed figure, okay? But it's considered at least once a day. That would be the minimum requirement, okay? Naturally, the more that you can say it, the better it is, okay? Kol Hamar Beharis and Mishuvah.
Well, it seems to me that since you're required to daven three
right,
times a day,
right, absolutely.
The requirement would be to say it three times
correct.
A day.
Correct, but of course we also know, you know, that you must say Kaddish in a minyan. You have to have
at least
a minyan present in order to recite Kaddish. Let's say that you're in a position, you know, where you can't say Kaddish because you're not with davening with a minyan. So in that case, you wouldn't say Kaddish. So if you could get to say it at least once a day, that would be already a mitzvah, you see. But, you know, it's because of the difficulty sometimes in making, you know, that you can engage for somebody else to recite Kaddish. Send a donation to yeshiva, ask them to recite Kaddish, or whatever the whatever arrangement you make for it. You know, somebody that you know, there'll always be somebody covering the situation and reciting the Kaddish.
Can one person say Kaddish for more than one person at a time?
Yes, yes. Just have to have in mind that he's saying it for this one, that one, and so on. Yeah. Yes, unfortunately. I take a look, there are yard sites over here. People, you know, we light the memorial lights. Not only are they no longer alive, their sons and daughters are no longer alive and things like that. I mean, we have tablets over here of people who died in 1917. No one left in the family. And even those who died more recently. And there's no one left to recite a Kaddish. It's the tragedy.
You know, is it right for the children say that a man has some sons, for the sons to pay someone else, say, Kaddish?
Well, they should do it as an emergency measure. The mitzvah is still for them to say it.
Right.
But
even
in case they miss, so at least, you know, you have like backup insurance, you see. You shouldn't rely upon the other one. You should try to do it yourself. This is the important part of the mitzvah. It's more meritorious, there's no question. But if you can't help it, then you do it the other way. All right. So... Since we are now talking, you know, about the problem of the dead, as So we saw, first of all, right, the Hamesim Einon Yodim Uma. We're going back again. First of all, we said Achayim Yodim, right? The dead, I mean, those who are alive know that they will die. That's the Pasafim Kahelis. And we said, this teaches us, and we went, you know, into the whole business about the Nayob and Yehudah, in order to teach us that what? That Sadikim Bechayehem Nikru Chayim, Sadikim Bechayehem Nikru Chayim, that the righteous in their death are called alive, because they are taking to their heart while they're alive the fact that you have to live a life of mitzvahs and Torah and Masik Torah and so on and so forth, so that when death occurs, you know that you'll be receiving, you know, your reward for the righteous life that you have lived, you see. But how about to whom does that part of the Pasuk refer to, that the dead do not know anything? So he says, Eidu Rishoyim, these are the wicked, Shebachayehem Kruim Mason, that even when they're alive, it's as if they were dead. Of course, it doesn't mean physically dead, but it means spiritually dead. Because obviously, a person who does not perform the slightest mitzvah is a Jew. He's dead as far as the Jewish people is concerned. Naturally, we hope that maybe a miracle will occur. Maybe this Pinter the Yid, you know, will
come alive.
Will flourish, will come to life again. But at any rate, as far as the present condition is concerned, there's no question that even though they're alive, but spiritually, they are dead. Shenemar, how do we learn this from Pasuk? It says, V'yato cholol rosho nasi Yisrael. You are a dead man, you wicked man, O you prince of Israel. This is Yechezkel, who's decrying the kind of Jewish leadership, the kind of kings that they had, that you know, they were wicked and led the people into wickedness. And so he says, you are a cholol, you're like a dead man, you wicked person. Okay? Now obviously he's addressing a person who is alive, he's not addressing someone who is dead, right? But from this we see that cholol rasha, that the rasha is like a cholol, is like a dead man.
A cholol here being the same as a cholol for referring to the Kohen who had a forbidden marriage.
That's a good question. Of course, over here, I mean, the two words are related to each other. There's no question. I mean, it's the same thing that they're also related to the word chulin, for chulin, example.
Right.
Okay? But as you can see, a word is susceptible in Hebrew. It can have different interpretations depending upon what the context is. Okay? Chalal has all kinds of meanings. Chalal, for example, means an empty space. Okay? That's one meaning of it. And so, for example, we use the word chalal today for like a vacuum. That's one meaning of the word, chalal. Alright? Chalal is used also in the sense of chalal cheret, in other words, literally hollowed out by the sword, in other words, pierced by the sword, and therefore a victim of the sword. And so the word chalal means also victim. Okay?
I see.
And then, of course, what you pointed out, chalal, in the case of the Kohen, refers to the fact that he has made his kahuna profane. And so, therefore, he is a chalal. And, of course, is what the Torah implies when it says, Isho zayin of a chalolo, lo yikochu. That the Kohen is not allowed to marry an Isho who is a zayinu, or a chalolo, or a gerusha, and so on and so forth. We learn the Gemara Kedusha.
Right.
Okay? V'iboy say more, and if you wish, mehocha. Maybe it comes from this pasuk. It's written, al pish daim edim, o shlosha edim yumas hameis. That by the testimony, literally by the mouth of, but let's say by the testimony of two witnesses or three witnesses, yumas hameis, the dead person shall be put to death. Okay, now obviously, how could you say the dead person should be put to death? He's alive, right? Chayhu, says the Gemara, that he's alive. Elo hameis mir kora. But he is like a dead person already to begin with. The very fact that he has been condemned to death even if the sentence has not yet been executed,
it's like a dead person.
Right, it's as if he is already considered a mace. So likewise from this we learn then that the Rasha is considered like a mace. Alright. B'nei Rabbi Chiya, the Fukla Kiryaso, the sons of Rabbi Chiya went out to the big city. Okay? Normally, Kirya means that, you know, that it's the big city. Okay? Iyakaluhu Tomidayu. What happened was that they were so busy trying to make a living once, you know, they got involved in big city life that their studies became difficult for them. And they had a great deal of trouble in trying to remember what they had learned, the Torah that they had learned. So So one of them said to the other, he says, Yoda Abun Bahitsara, tell me, do you think that father knows about Atzoras? Omale Idos, and the other one said to him, Mino Yoda, how should he know? The Hoksiv, isn't it written? Yichbidu Bono Velo Yeda. Literally, his sons grow heavy. In other words, you know, could mean that the literal meaning is really over there in the book of Iyov that they come to honor, okay? But you know that the word kaved in Hebrew has different meanings. Again, while one interpretation is related to the word of kavod and kaved and so on, right? But kaved as an adjective also means heavy. So that here he's taking it, you know, as I said again many times, when it comes to a drash on a pasuk, you don't always go for the literal interpretation. There is a literal interpretation, but when you make a drash, in other words, an interpretation, you want the interpretation to teach a particular lesson. Okay? So what is the lesson that this particular verse says, that yichbidu bono v'lo yeda, in other words, his sons become heavy, in other words, they have tzoras, you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The sons have tzoras v'lo yeda, and he doesn't know, because he's dead. So omale yidach, so the other brother said to him, v'lo yada, what do you mean? He doesn't know? The hawk said, don't we have a posik which says, ach b'soro alov yichav? Again, talking about the dead, and it says, surely his flesh is, yichav, is painful to him. In other words, even though he's dead, but he feels pain in his body, right, in his flesh. And his soul mourns for him. And this leads us to an interpretation of Rabbi Yitzchak, who said, "Kosho rimo l'meis kemacha b'fosor chai," that the worms are as difficult for the dead person. In other words, the worms that begin crawling into the dead person are as hard upon him as sticking a needle in raw flesh. If we would stick a needle into our raw flesh, we know how painful that is. So in other words, even though the person is dead, but the very fact that the worms have entered his body and are digging and eating, you know, this is painful to the flesh. So, therefore, this interpretation would tell us what? That the dead do have feelings, even though they're dead, but they have feelings, and therefore they also, if they have feelings, then they should be aware of the tzoras of the living. You understand? Yes. Right. Of course, that's a different.
In
Pirkei Avos, right. You know, one of the statements over there is Marbibosa Marbirimo, that the more flesh that you consume, literally, or maybe the fatter you are, it all depends how you take it, Marbirimo, you're only going to have more worms. Those are the bad things, you know, when it comes to having too much. On the other hand, you know, Marbe Chochma, Marbe Tabuno, the more wisdom you have, the more understanding you have, and Marbe Torah, Marbe Chaim, which is the conclusion that the more Torah you study, the greater the life you'll have. And this is why we're gathered over here, to be Marbe Torah, Marbe Chaim, that we should have. with the Rebbe Shalom himself.
That's why some want these heavy metal caskets and all that.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, first of all, it became a goyish trait.
Yeah.
Right, that they felt, you know, that the heavy metal casket, this would be an insurance against the flesh being consumed. Well, I don't have to tell you. A lot of money is being spent on nothing. But it's tragic, unfortunately, when you see Jewish people who have succumbed to the same values, so to speak, of the Goyish world itself. And of course, you know, the funeral director is very, very happy to sell you a casket for $4,000 or $5,000 in preference to one which would only cost, let's say, $400 or $500 or something like that.
Mm.
You know, like a plain wooden one. I don't know what the going price is today, but it makes a difference. And the question is, why do we need these expensive things? We need the plush lining, do we need the fancy steel and stuff like that? So, well, all right, so Amre, so there are those who say Bitzara did who yade, but Bitzara da achuna lo yade. In other words, okay, the mess is aware. There are those who say that the mess is aware of the pain that he himself feels, but he's unaware of the pain that others feel. In other words, you know, these two boys are arguing back and forth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, one of them is convinced that father knows what's going on, and he marshals his psukim, his verses, in order to show that. And the other one marshals his psukim in order to show that father is undoubtedly unaware of our tzar. So this last opinion, you know, would support that point of view over there. Below, so now the Gemara asks, what do you mean? He's not aware of the tzoras of other people? The Hotanya, and here we have a very interesting story. Okay? We have learned a story in the Gemara which says, Ma'asa b'chosid echad, it's a story told about a certain pious person, Shenotzan dinor le'yoni b'yev Rosh Hashanah. He gave, you know, a dinar is, you know, a sizable coin, okay, to a poor man who, you know, asked for a nedava. And when did it happen? It happened to be Erev Rosh Hashanah, okay? And it was also Vishnei Batzoris. It happened to be during years of famine, okay? It was a time of famine. V'hiknitehu yishtel, so his wife gave him a hard time, obviously, because she figured that she needed the money more than the poor person. So she gave him a hard time. And what did he do? Obviously, she said, don't you dare come into this house or something like that. So where did he go to spend the night? He went to spend the night of Rosh Hashanah in the cemetery.
Hmm.
Lay down in the cemetery. That's where he went to sleep. And he heard two spirits that were conversing with each other. In other words, two dead girls, and their spirits were having a conversation. And he was listening in over there in the base, you know, in the base of forest in the cemetery. So one of them said to the other one, Chaverti, friend, right? Boi v'noshut bo ilom v'nishman v'yachvei pargot ma'apuranus bo ilom. Come, she says, and let us go flying about in the world and let's find out from behind the curtain. Now what is behind the curtain? In this case it means, you know, up in the heavenly abode. Okay, let's find out up in the heavenly abode ma'apuranus bo ilom, what kind of difficulties, what kind of punishment is going to come to the world. In other words, how is the world going to be hit hard? So the other one said, Eini Yechola, I can't go with you. Why? Shani kibur b'machzela shel kodem. I happen to be buried in a mat of reeds. Okay, in other words, it's not an appropriate outfit that I'm wearing in order to go flying with you in order to find out what's going on, with, you know, in the secret world, okay? Elulachiyat, but you go. Mashat Shamas Imrili. And whatever you hear, go and tell me, all right? So Holchahi, she went, in other words, you know, the other one went. Vishota, and she went flying. Vavon, she came. Viomalo Chavirta, and she said, and her companion said to her, Chavirti, my friend, Mashamat Pinachriya Pako, tell me, what did you hear over there? So Omrolo, she said to her, Shamati Shekol Hazorea Birbio Rishono, I heard that whoever is going to plant seed during the first rainy season, Borod Malke Oso, then the hail is going to come and smite it. It's going to hit it. In other words, it will, you know, be destroyed by hail. So, you know, this chosid was there listening in, you know, to the conversation. So what didn't he do? Holachu v'zora b'rviyashnir. So he went and he sowed his seed not during the first rainy season, but during the second rainy season. Okay? So, shalkol ha'waylam kulei loka. The fields, or let's say the crops that belong to everybody, they were affected by the, you know, by the shidofa, by the hail, right? But shelo lo loka, his, however, did not suffer any damage. Lashon ha'acheres, so the following year, holach belov beis hakoros. So he again went, this time I guess his wife didn't throw him out of the house, but anyway he went and he decided to sleep over in the cemetery.
Shema.
Okay.
And he heard,
yeah, I just want to add one thing. Like a sidelight to the story. Namely that there is, you know, a Gemara which says, it's based upon a Pasuk. The Pasuk in, towards the end of Sefer Devarim says, that, you know, the land of Israel, the Ribbono Shel Olam takes care of this land. Er she'ineinu Hashem nekecho bo, right? The eyes of the Lord are upon it. Meireish shana v'yad achri shana, from the beginning of the year until the very end of the year. In other words, God's providence is over Eretz Israel right from the beginning to the end. So that, therefore, the Gemara says in Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that on Rosh Hashanah, the Ribbono Shel Olam decrees what is going to happen during the course of the next year, as far as, you know, whether there'll be famine or whether there'll be plenty and things like that and so on. So this, I would say, is probably, it helps us understand better. I mean, why did he decide to go, you know, on Rosh Hashanah night and go and sleep in the cemetery to find out, you know, what is the decree, Me'acharei HaParvot, right? What is the decree that's coming down from behind the curtain, right? So, Omwala, so she said, Holach Balom Veis HaKvoros, Vishoma Osan Shtei Bruchos, and again, they heard these two spirits, Shem Sapros of Zod, that they were having conversation with each other. Omwa Chalal Chaberto, so one of them said to her girlfriend, Boi v'noshut bo'ilam, come and let us go fly about in the world. V'nishba mi'achvei ha'pargod, ma'apuron is bo'ilam. Let's find out, you know, what kind of penalty is going to come to the world. So, omelo chavelti. So, the other one said to her, my girlfriend, she says, lo kachem alti lo, didn't I tell you already? Eini yecholah, I can't go, I don't have the proper outfit, right? Sha'ani kibur of matzela shel kodim, I am buried, you know, in a mat made of reeds. Ela lechiyat, you go. Amashat shemaz boy the imuli. So you go, and whatever you hear, come and tell me. Holcha v'shoto. So she went. She went flying. Gavo v'yomro lo chaverto. So when she came back, you know, the girlfriend again said, "Chaverti, ma shemat me'achrei apargo. Tell me, what did you hear?" Omvalo shomati, she said to her, I have heard that whoever plants seed in the second rainy season, Shidofon Malkoso, then, you know, the plague will come and strike it, okay? Holach v'zorah v'radiyah rishena. So what did he do? He planted a seed during the first rainy season. Naturally, what did everybody else do? They based their experience on the previous year, and therefore, when did they plant it?
The second one.
And the second one. All right, so what was the result? So, shokolo v'ilam kulei nishtab. Everybody else's, you know, crop was smitten. The shalolo nishta, but his was not smitten. So Amolo Yishto, his wife said to him, tell me, for what reason last year everybody else has suffered and you didn't suffer? V'yachshav, and now also shalkol hoylam kulei nishta, v'shalkol nishta, this time again, everybody else is smitten, you know, with the mildew or whatever the shidofon is, and yours is not. So he told her all these words. Omru, so they say that lo hayu yomim muotim ad shenofta ketota bein ishto shaloysa chosid bein imo shaloysa mila. Well, I think it's getting time, so we're going to keep this cliffhanger waiting until next week. And the only problem with next week that we have, I don't know if it's a problem, there's the Yom Yerushalayim program. Now, we could learn next week until whatever time, but what I'm wondering is how are we going to coordinate with the davening? This is what the problem is.
I'm not sure. We have the commitment there at 8.
Yeah.
Minyan will continue here, of course, and will be held at 8, as always.
Okay. So I'll tell you, we'll learn at 7 o'clock next week as usual. And 8 o'clock we'll daven mincha maariv, do a psahuri of job, and then we'll go over and try to take part as much as we can.
Where
okay.
Is it?
Hold off on Rabbi.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you for reminding me. Although I think I remember.
We're on
Yud Ches, the second side,
right?
Yeah. Wait for David to finish talking.
Geshet. See, I've been practicing this all day.
I see, you're studying hard. I can see that thing.
You know, you can do it even driving in a car. I mean, yeah. Sitting at your desk or something.
Who do you talk to? Who do you talk to?
I'm just conjugating.
Oh, conjugating of verbs.
I'm working a little bit on Hebrew grammar. Right now.
I see.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Trying to learn all regalachas, all the the basic Hebrew and grammatical forms.
Yeah.
Okay. So as we saw, and we started in, right, that the question, of course, that is raised, I mean, that started this all of this whole business was, do the dead have any feelings, number one? And we said yes. We quoted the Gemara, which says that kosher rimul ameis, you know, that the worms is difficult for the dead person, kamacha b'vosav chai, as a needle in living flesh. In other words, just as if you would stick a needle into your flesh, you would feel it. So the same thing, even the dead feel the rima. That's one thing. And then the question is, okay, how about the dead? Are they aware of what's going on in this world? And then, of course, once we finish that, the question is, and can they communicate with people who are in this world, you see? So that this is the problem that we'll be discussing. All right, so we started off with the story about the two young girls, right, well, there's one was a woman, the other was a young girl, right? They were buried in the Beis Elam. And this happened to be the night of Rosh Hashanah, and this guy got into a fight with his wife because he gave tzedakah, and the wife begrudged him giving the tzedakah, and so he saw that she kicked him out of the house, and for a little peace he went to the Beis HaKvaros in order to have a peaceful night over there, right? And while he was there, so he heard these two talking to each other, and you know, as I mentioned last week too, the Gemara says, you know, that not this Gemara, but the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, you know, that on Rosh Hashanah it is determined by the Rabbeinu Shel Olam who is going to have money, is the world is there going to be enjoying a year of prosperity, of enough rainfall and things like that, and so on and so forth. Because it is written, Meireish Shana v'yad Achrish Shana. Meireish Shana, in other words, from the beginning of the year right to the very end of the year, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam makes this decision at that particular time. That's how they interpret the pasuk. Okay? So, he went, and while he was there, lying on the ground, lo and behold, he heard these two talking to each other. And of course, what did they say? So one of them said, you know, why don't we let's go on a flight around the world and we'll see, you know, what's doing Be'achri HaParvot up there in heaven, you know, what kind of heavenly secrets we can find out. What is the future and so on. So the younger one said, you know, I can't go because I am in a mat of reeds. It's pastish, it's not, you know, very nice for me to go around wearing a mat of reeds. I mean, it's not the right clothing for me to go.
Why would she have a mat of reeds?
Huh?
Why would she have
it? Okay, well, the reason being that very often, and this was a custom even in many countries up to the present day, that instead of burying them in coffins, they would simply, you know, wrap them in the tachrichim, take them out on the mita, which, as we explained, this is the bier upon which the dead person is carried to the Beis HaKvaros, you know, to the cemetery, and then they bury them in the ground. Right. That's what they did.
Without a coffin.
Without a coffin, correct. You know, the use of coffins is a more modern invention. But this is the way they used to do it, and in fact in Europe they were still doing it in certain areas, and even in Eretz Yisrael they were doing it in certain areas, you know, where they were following tradition and people were very poor and they couldn't afford, you know, the cost of coffins, so that this was a custom. Okay, so she apparently didn't like, you know, what kind of tachrichim she was wearing. Instead she says, I'm only buried, you know, in a mat of reeds is what they covered me with, and so on. And therefore, it's pastish. I mean, this is not the right outfit to go flying around the world and go into heaven and, you know, to find out, you know, what's doing over there. So, you go. All right, so then we learned, you know, that the other one came back, and when she came back, she says, so, what did you hear? So, she heard that Kol HaSareh B'Riviyah Rishraidah Boret Malkah, he said. That whoever sows seed during the first rain, then hail is going to come and smite the crop. So what did this chassid do? He didn't sow his seed during the first one, but he sowed it and said Berviyashniyah, right, in the second rainy season. Rashi explains about the rainy season. Of course, it's based upon Gemara and Tainus over there, where they deal with the question of rain and lack of rain, and the fast that they ordained, you know, for if there was a drought in the land and so on. Okay. That if you take a look in the Rashi, just below the, where it's big over there.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Rashi gives an interpretation. What does it mean by the word haparkod? Okay. And he says that this is a mechitza. Right?
This is the
right below the first big light on top, okay?
Okay?
So he explains the word cargo. Cargo means mechitza, amabdeles be'mokom be'mekom hashrina. This is a, like a mechitza which may, you know, it makes a separation between the world and where God's divine presence is to be found. All right. Now he explains, what is the Revi'a Rishona? He says, this is the Yoreh. You know, when we say in the second paragraph of the Shema Yisrael, you know, Yoreh Malkosh, right? So the question is, what is the meaning of the word Yoreh? So he says, Shalosh Revi'a Yishen, Bechirosh Ni'osh Lishis. You see the Rashi over there? Alright, so he says that there are three, literally quarters, in other words, it means three different periods in this particular case of rain. Okay? Bechira means the first one. Shniyo is the second one, and Shlishi is, of course, the third one. What is the first one? Rishona. It says it's been Yud Zayin B'Cheshvan, right? In other words, on the 17th of Cheshvan, this is when the first rains are normally expected in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? And how about the second one? Shniyo says B'Chov Gimel. In other words, on the 23rd of Cheshvan, this is when the second rain falls. In other words, it's assumed that if it falls on the 17th, it doesn't necessarily have to rain for the entire week. It could rain maybe 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, okay? And then comes another rainy period, and this is the one that begins on the 23rd of Cheshvan, and then a week later, approximately, on Rosh Chodesh Kislev, this is when the third rainfall comes in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. The Rashi over here.
Yeah.
Doing.
I see.
Yeah, over there. Right.
Do you think that's happening today too, the same way with three rains?
Approximately, right. I mean, after all, this is based upon the geography of Eretz Yisrael. Okay. And as I say, our source for when the rains normally come, this we find in the Gemara Tainis, where it deals specifically the first couple of chapters. Deals specifically with the question of when do we start into say Mashav Ruach, when do we start into say Talamotor, when is the rainy season, what happens if there's a drought, then what prayers do we recite in order to try to beg the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to send rain, and if the drought persists, then what is the next step, and so on and so forth. It's a very, very colorful Gemara. And it has very, very beautiful agadata as well. Some of the famous agadas, some of the famous stories, about people in the Talmud are to be found over there in Maseches Tanis. But of course, Brachos too has some tremendous agadah as well, as we can see over here.
I'm thinking in terms of, in any way suggesting that Hashem is not doing this. Rain and so forth. But I kind of wonder when this was all written, Eretz Yisrael was a land of milk and honey, and not what it is today.
Yeah.
It's sparse here, all over the place mostly. Because of that, I would think that the rainy season is different there, because there's just not enough moisture going up to create the clouds and make the rain. This is what I thought. That's why it would be different today.
No, it isn't necessarily so. Of course, once upon a time, Eretz Yisrael was talking of the land of milk and honey, but what happened? What happened is that it was destroyed by Babylonians, then it was destroyed by Romans, it was destroyed by Arabs. They came and they destroyed the land.
But
right,
because
okay.
Of that, you don't have the lush things we have out here.
Except what, since the time that the Jews have come back to Eretz Yisrael, what they have accomplished, okay?
They've done enough, that much.
Well, they certainly have, but part of it is due to the fact that the Jews have made a science out of trying to conserve as much of the rainfall and as much as, as much of the water that they can get, let's say, from the Yarden, from the Kinneret, and so on and so forth, so that they can make the greatest use of that. This is why they developed all kinds of irrigation plans. And when you go to Eretz Yisrael, and also, by the way, they try to make sure that the water doesn't simply, let's say, run off the ground, but, it can be collected, it can be reused if they possibly can, things like that, in order to try to conserve as much as they can. But in Eretz Yisrael, they still begin reciting Talamata exactly the way the Gemara says. The Gemara says to begin doing it on the seventh day of Cheshvan, which would be, as you can see, just shortly before the rainy season is actually expected to begin. Our custom is different because ours is based upon Bavel. In Bavel, the climatic conditions were quite different from Eretz Yisrael. As the Gemara tells us, that Eretz Yisrael is a land, the Torah says, Eretz Horim Uvikos, in other words, it's a land with mountains and valleys and so on and so forth, whereas Bavel is flat land. And of course, Eretz Yisrael has only one river practically, to give it a source of water, namely the Jordan River. And Babylonia had two tremendous rivers, the Pras and Chidekel, or as we call them, the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? And they had a whole system of canals running between the two waters. They had much more rainfall, apparently, and so on and so forth.
Are they still
so.
In existence?
Yeah, the rivers are still there, absolutely. But what happened is that when the Arabs came along, they managed to destroy all the canals that had existed, you know. Zavil de Chayes, I'm telling you. The Bnei Shalalem should forgive me for thinking not very well of Archeinu Bnei Yishmael, you know, but wherever they've come, they're destroyed.
Well, you know, actually, interesting what you're saying. I was thinking, you know, the Zionists dream about replanting trees. Now, if you think about it, wonder if you see the Etzrach Hashem, because the tree, through photosynthesis, produces oxygen. And it's oxygen that leads, as you say, eventually to the condensation, which produces rain.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, I'm getting out of my, leaning way out of my depth, in a way you could say that the Jews themselves somehow altered their, use a fancy word, ecology or environment, in a way possibly produce more rain.
Well, I do know that they put up
possibly,
a tremendous forest,
sure,
the Arabs went to burn it down.
Well, the Turks were the ones, you know, it wasn't so much the Arabs, the Turks were the ones that destroyed the forests.
Yeah. But they're also B'nai Yishmael.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not Arabs, but certainly they belong to the same religion and so on. And to them, I mean, it didn't mean anything. Eretz Yisrael was South Syria or something like that, you know. This is the basis upon which Syria claims, you know, that Eretz Yisrael belongs to them.
On what basis?
It was South Syria, according to the Turks.
South Syria?
Yeah. Right. That's how much they thought, you know, very just well.
So this,
okay.
So this Chassid planted his seed with the second rain.
Correct. In other words, the first time around, he planted it during the Revi'i Shniyah when the second rain was falling. So what was the result? The result was that everybody else, their crops were smitten by hail, and his escaped so that he did well. And then, of course, what happened the following year? Mm-hmm. He decided it's a good thing, so he went out to the Beis Elam again. Yes.
Well,
this time his wife didn't chase him out.
Doesn't say that.
Getting back to this history, if you think about Chag Hanukkah to the Yavanim, Eretz Israel was Syria. Correct?
Yeah,
the way
correct.
They divided up their empire.
Right. Right. The first Eretz Israel, historically.
Syria encompassed Eretz Israel. I mean, whoever was the.
Yeah, after they had conquered it from Egypt. The original division by Alexander the Great, because he died.
Right.
But his big generals, you know, divided up the lands that he had conquered.
Right.
So one of them, Seleucus, became the guy in Syria, and the other one, Ptolemy, became the king, the emperor of Egypt, okay? And by
and
the terms of the division, right, exactly. First,
there
was Israel belonged to Ptolemy, to Egypt, and then there was a war between the Egyptian king and the Syrian king, and this is how... I think it was actually during the reign of Antiochus the Third, who beat the Egyptian army, and he took over Eretz Israel. And then Antiochus the Fourth was his son.
And my point is
that Eretz Israel by itself,
but even from the time of the Yavanim, which was about, let's say 300 BC, there's already a precedent for Eretz Israel being part of Syria. You don't even have to wait for the Turks.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Right, yeah. So
no, but I think what Philip's saying is that the Turks considered...
But prior to that, Eretz Yisrael was independent. After the victory of the Hashmonaim, again, Eretz Yisrael became independent, except that the stupid kings decided to call in Rome. And when they did that, they didn't know what they were doing. Maybe Rome would have interfered anyway, this I don't know. But the fact is that the Jews actively, that is the kings, you know, they actively invited Rome to step in because of a rivalry between two brothers.
Right.
Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Each one wanted to be the king, so Because they played politics. No, no. Unfortunately, and we suffer as a result of this.
So the next year he went out to the cemetery again.
Next year he went out to the cemetery again to hear what's new, and again the same story, you know. And she says, I told you I can't go on a trip. Why don't you go and tell me what you hear? Okay. So she came back again this time, right? And she said, I hear that, you know, this time whoever sows in the first Revia, so he will be lucky. Because those who come in the second one, so it will be shidofon, which is, you know, a disease, mildew or whatever it is. Sometimes they translate it as blasting. To me, blasting doesn't mean very much, but it's a form of mildew or something which ruins the crops too. Okay, so what did he do this time? He sowed during the first revia, during the first rainfall. Everybody else, having seen the lesson last year, that those who had sown the seed during the first revia, their crops were destroyed, so they waited for the second one. And this time again, what happened?
Yeah.
Right, so
yeah,
this time, right, their crops were destroyed, and his crop again was saved. So, of course, the wife wants to know, new talk, explain to me, how come everybody else was hurt, everybody else, their crops were destroyed, and yours was okay. All right. So in that particular case, yeah. So we are now over there, right at approximately where the first big line is over there, going down. Okay.
The big line.
Yeah. First, just before it. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, he says, you know, she asked him, how come yours wasn't destroyed? So Sochlokoladronweila, right? So he told her the Gansamaisa. You know what had happened. Omru, this is where we left off last time. Lehoyu yomim uatim, that not much time passed, achenotha ketoto, and a quarrel broke out, bein ishto shelosaposit, between this pious person's wife, uvein imo shel oiso riba, and the mother of that young girl who had died.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So omru lo, so what did this... you know, the wife say to the other woman, she said, L'chiv yarech b'teich, sheikvu b'chzel shel kodim. Says, come, let me show you your daughter who is buried in a mat of reeds. Mm. Naturally, what is she taking her? She wants to make her feel ashamed of the fact, you know, that her daughter is not buried with decent tachrichim, but instead is buried, you know, right, with the Matzela Shel Kadim. Shonoha Acheres, so the following year, Holach Ben-Lon Beis HaKvaros. So again, he went to the Beis Elam, and he spent the night over there. V'shamosan v'ucho shemesapros v'mzu. And again, he heard these spirits talking to one another. Om v'lo kaverti. And again, one of them said, you know, girl, my girlfriend, my friend, Boi v'noshut boi lom, come, let us go and fly about the world, v'nishman v'yachrei ha'pargod, ma'apuron es bo lo'ilam, and let's find out, you know, from behind the curtain, what evil disaster is threatening the world. Omer lo, chavelti hanicheni. So she said to her, my girlfriend, let me alone. Devorim shebeini lebeineich kvo nishmu b'nafayim. Those things that we had discussed in private, they have already been heard by the people
who
are still living. So Almo, from this story, what do we see? We see that Yadeh, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the dead, in other words, are aware of what's going on. Okay? They do know what's going on in this world. So, that's the question. Do they or don't?